Hi, and welcome to the They Call Me the Ghost podcast, a podcast for those looking for good stories, looking for adventure. This is a special double feature about Inner Earth. The first episode deals with one man's journey home as he travels back to his origins. The second episode deals with the secrets that threaten this beautiful world. Narrated by me, the ghost, each and every time. Let's get started. Episode 1, Inner Earth and One Man's Journey Home. The job I'll be talking about today has to do with a topic many have asked about. Is there an inner earth? What is hollow earth? This request came to me from a man, a self-made man, whose quest and personal mission is to travel to inner earth. Says his family's mission is complete and it's time for him to go home. He claims there's a lot more to the planet we call Earth than just the giant ball we think it is. And he's done with any ideas of going on any organized expeditions to the center of the Earth, requiring the work of many. Instead, he wants to go alone and calls on me to help guide him and secure him on his journey. They call me the Ghost. I'm ex-CIA and now a dark operative on the dark web. I've worked a lot of jobs, and today is my account of what happened while helping one man reach his destiny and finding validity in a long-time, often fantasized about theory. Take a listen and enjoy. Okay, this request was unique, to say the least. Not that any of them aren't. But when this one came in, the very first thing that we did was verify that this man was for real and not just being held up in a mental institution somewhere with internet time on his hands. Well, he wasn't. This man was for real. He was successful, although he stayed pretty quiet. We verified him to be a multifaceted engineer who focused on inventions. He held many patents and had a lot of experience in energy and manufacturing, and he had a personal interest in space. I mean, this guy was interesting and no dummy either. This request definitely got my attention when he said that he needed assistance on his journey to inner Earth. I mean, I wanted to know more. I accept the invitation to meet in San Diego the following evening. And when I arrive there, I'm met by a driver. You know, he's standing there with my name on a sign. Anyway, he acknowledges who I am and who my requester is, and all's good, and we drive for a little while. You know, my requester told me he would pick the meeting place, so I'm not exactly sure where I'm going. But the driver lets me know finally that we're meeting at his house. Well, one of his houses. And we get there, and I have to tell you, this place was amazing. And first of all, you know, the sun was going to be setting soon, so with all that light bouncing off the stone and the stucco on the side of the house, orange, I mean, the house just glowed. And I get dropped off right out front where I'm met by a woman. So she then takes me through the house and to the guest house out back. This place is beautiful. We get my bag and things dropped off because apparently I'll be staying there. And then she tells me that he, well, I'll just call him Brennan, is ready for me. So we walk from the guest house and across this giant patio area. I mean, there's a pool, a fountain, a fire pit, and he is waiting for me at this big wooden table. He's got candles and snacks and all this stuff. Tells me to have a seat. And I'm ready, you know, to get to know this man. But he starts out sort of asking me questions. He tells me that I come highly recommended, but since he can't really find anything on me anywhere, he wants to ask me about my jobs, particularly the ones from people that he knows that referred him to me. So I tell him about a few things, and he really seemed to enjoy listening to my stories. And then he says that his job is going to top them all. He tells me that his father left for the same journey he's looking to take 30 years ago, never came back. Told Brennan and his mother that he would return, but he never did. Brennan went on to finish school. He advanced himself quickly in the world of manufacturing and energy, and he was preparing himself, you know, to leave his mark. He was also preparing himself to leave. His mother passed away 5 years before, and before she went, she made him promise her that he would make it back. He knew it was his generation that was set to return, and when he did return, his family's mission would be complete. So he made her that promise, and now is the time. So I wanted to know what mission this was and why he and his family were sent here. Without me even having to ask, he starts to go into all of it. And there's a book that's on the table to the left of him, and he sets it down in between us and says that it's a book from his father, passed on to him from his father. And it's a leather book, probably, I don't know, 6x9 or something like that. Black leather with worn pages on the inside. And he tells me it contains the family legend. And that as it's been told to him, he is from a bloodline not of outer earth. That his earlier generations were from the inside. His family kept the stories alive over the years with the goal of returning one day. And Brennan always knew that he was of that generation that was set to go back. Over the years, he and his mother formed a close bond. They always got together on the anniversary of his father's departure, just as they did for holidays and other celebrations. It was just the two of them. As far as how his family got there, he tells me that it was his grandfather that came over first as an explorer from the inside. And when he came, he brought his son. His son would then go on to marry Brennan's now mother. And then along came Brennan. Although technically a half-breed, since his father married a woman from the surface, which never happens, he didn't lack any of the loyalties or pull to his inner homeland. He grew up with all the traditions and detailed accounts of those that came before him. His parents never had any more children, and he always felt a little bit different than the other kids around him and adults, even as he grew up. His focus became his work, and his work focused on the study of life and technologies here. He wanted to know as much as he could about what went on so that he could bring that information back to his people. When he finally got there, and he made it his life's mission to get there. And 6 years ago, he got wind of an expedition to the North Pole, and he finagled his way in. Although he knew there was a very good chance this would fail, he wanted to at least see how people were attempting to get to inner Earth. You know, were they close, and what did they know? Well, the whole thing turned out to be a bust. They said they had this fully capable icebreaker boat, but it didn't do a very good job. They were low on supplies, not low on the drama. There's tons of completely unnecessary drama. It was overwhelming, he said. The crew didn't seem to know too much, but in their defense, they weren't lacking the enthusiasm, and they were smart. He said it was an adventure, for sure, but when it came time for him to take his real trip, his final trip, he wanted to do it alone. And that was that, until just over a year ago. He was at a cafe, sitting by himself, eating a scone and having coffee, when this young girl walks up to him. You know, she's polite. She tugs on his sleeve. She says, "Excuse me." He looks down at her and said the first thing that he noticed were her eyes. They were the same shade of green as his own. I mean, there's a lot of green-eyed people out there, but he had never seen anyone with this particular shade of darker green in the eyes of anyone else. This girl's eyes were that color. She told him, "This is for you." And she hands him this leather sack. And Brennan said he had no idea what was going on, which is understandable. And when she reached up to hand him the bag, he notices her skin on her little hands and arms. It was sunny that day, and her skin almost shimmered in the light. The only other person he ever met with skin like that was his father. His skin didn't do that so much because he was not a full-blooded insider. So he accepts this bag, but then he instantly starts looking around, you know, for any grown-ups that are there looking for their child or who did this kid belong to. But there was no one. He stands up, he looks farther down the street and inside the cafe, but there's no one looking for their child and no one seems out of place. So he turns back to his table to sit down, and this young girl is now gone. He stands up again, he's looking for this girl everywhere, but she's nowhere. So he had no idea what just happened, but he immediately left there and went to his loft. He was in New York at the time, by the way. Apparently he has a loft there in addition to his house in San Diego. Anyway, he gets up there, and feeling like someone could be in there, he sweeps the whole place. Then he locks up and settles in on his couch to open the bag. He found what looked like a map, of course, to what he didn't know, a little book, and a note. He opens the note first. Now, while he's talking, he reaches down to the floor and picks up this briefcase. And it's secured, so he punches in a code and pops it open. He pulls out this piece of paper, slides the briefcase out of the way, and hands me the paper. It's a yellowish kind of paper. It's thick and rough, not really paper we would use in our everyday. But anyway, he hands it to me, and he tells me to read it. And so I do, out loud. And it said, "It is your time to come home to the inside, bringing with you what you have learned as an outsider. I'm an old man now, but the time for you is now. Remember what I told you, and be bold and brave in your travels." Signed, your father, and then his name. Brennan also had a smaller pouch, and inside of that was this small leather bracelet that was also in the leather bag. The bracelet is leather. It has beads on it, and there's this hanging piece of metal of some kind, like a little medallion. And he tells me that this piece, this bracelet, authenticates the message. It was the final piece for him to know that this message was for real, because that little bracelet was made for him by his father. So he's the only one that would have it. And the little medallion that hung down had a symbol on it. And he tells me it's the symbol of his world, of Inner Earth. And it was engraved, and it had this eye, so, you know, this drawing of this eye with these long lines that came off the edges. And the eye floated above this perfect circle that had these swirls coming in and out of it. And he said it all basically meant something like, may you always be present in your peace and prosperity. So pretty cool. But I mean, I had a lot of questions after this. I mean, first of all, who is this girl? Were there more of them here? And why wouldn't he know them? Well, he knew exactly what I was thinking, must have read my mind. And he went on to tell me that there have always been travelers here from the inside. However, their code is to stay anonymous, even from each other. They don't want to form any groups that could be noticed. And his dad never came back and couldn't really go on to explain how this all worked. And he never explained it to him before because Brennan was too young. To have told Brennan about it while he was young was a risk. Their code would have been to wait and tell him about how they left and how to get back until when he was an adult and established and could understand. Before that time, they would be considered vulnerable to outside influence. Brennan was born on the surface, on the outside. But as a rule, one can only travel to the outside with their kids if they were younger than 3 years old, because they didn't want them to realize what was happening. It was the risk they might tell someone. Either way, he would not and does not know the girl, and will likely never know her or see her again. She was just the messenger, from whom he didn't know, and he would never seek to find out. It's just the way that they worked. And they all respected that. Anyone sent here was on a mission. They were highly skilled, and they were actually chosen to come, live and survive on the surface, and then one day return with updates and information from the outside. This was obviously a call he couldn't ignore. He knew it was his time. I mean, and I'm just sitting there listening to this guy. It's a lot to take in, but this guy was for real. And just when he gets done talking about all that stuff, he breaks out even more. He reaches into his briefcase, and now he pulls out this rolled up piece of paper, takes off the binding and unrolled it, and he held it down with his briefcase and his glass on the other side, and he lays it out. It's the map. It's very colorful and on the same yellowish paper. And he tells me that this map holds the secret, tells me it's one of the real ways to get to Inner Earth, and that so many people that are trying to get there are all going about it the wrong way. You know, the hyped up stories that tell of the North and South Pole having giant holes that lead to the inside. Well, he points to the map and he shows me New Zealand. And he says it's there he must go, and through there he will find his way home. And I asked him, you know, why me? Why like this? And he tells me this trip is the one. He can't risk any followers. He can't be in the media. You know, that this trip cannot be known by anyone else. And then he tells me that I have a choice. You know, he can either pay me, he'll pay me very well, or he can just take me to the inside and let me see it all for myself. Of course, my time there would be brief and I couldn't stay, but just as they explore, our world deserves explorers too, he said, but only those that can be trusted. And he feels I am one of those people. We talk about how I work and who I work with. You know, I have my own life to live, and I am not going to be doing this by myself. I count on my team, and they count on me, and we agree that we can work that out. So, yes, I take this job, and yes, I want to go in, of course. He shakes my hand, and he tells me that his home is now my home. What he has is also mine, and he welcomes me as his partner as he embarks on this journey to leave our world. He puts everything back in his briefcase and locks it. And then just a few minutes later, this woman dressed like a chef comes out and asks him if he's ready. And he says, yes. I mean, this guy has his own chef. And it turns out that she made an incredible dinner for us. We had pork with this basil sauce and these best green beans I think I've ever had, bread, salad. It was incredible. After dinner, I make sure my team is ready to come the next day so we can discuss the details of what Brennan knows, how we would like to go about this, who will all be going, things like that. You know, make the plan. And the rest of that night, we just shared stories. He told me some of the stories that have been passed down through their generations and will always be. And it's those stories, you know, that keep them grounded in the fact that they may be here, but they're not meant to stay. It was a very cool evening with this guy. You know, I went to bed that night not really knowing at all what we were going to find, but after getting to know him and finding out about his family and his world, I'm fully committed to getting Brennan home. The next morning, I meet him for coffee, and soon enough, my team is there to join us. And we're at the bigger wood table in the back of his house. And for this meeting, Brennan sits himself at the head of the table, and we're lined up to the left and right of him. You know, we're all ears. He stands up and he pulls out this board that he had resting up by the table. And he's temporarily mounted that map to it so we can all see it. The words are in a language that, you know, me and my team don't know, but the hand-drawn picture is clear. It's a picture of the Bay of Islands off of New Zealand. There are 144 islands there. We would fly into Auckland, New Zealand. Yep, Lord of the Rings, they filmed there. But anyway, we're going to fly into Auckland, and then Brennan already has his yacht and crew waiting for us there. And because Brennan knows people there that will see us leaving, he doesn't want them to notice that when we come back, he's not there. So when we come back, we're going to fly out of Kerikeri, and we'll take his private jet both ways. I already know that this is going to be a strange trip, you know, taking him to this place and then coming back without him. But anyway, he shows us all where we're going to be going. So after we get to Auckland and get over any jet lag, we will be heading out on his yacht. He has a 60-foot catamaran. I mean, what does this guy not have? We'll board the yacht when we're ready, and then we'll set sail from Auckland and out to the South Pacific. There are coordinates on the map, and Brennan tells us that that is where we will take to diving, which he told me about, and my guys came with items for that. We will not return to the surface until me and my team are heading home, and it will be without him. As far as who goes, I just say, you know, the more people that can come, the more we can learn and the more information we can bring back with us. He will need us, you know, to be his eyes. We will need to watch and, you know, for anyone tracking him or following him. And if we find anyone, they need to be removed from the situation. We go over the items that Brennan wants to take with him. So we're all going to have extra items on our person inside our suits, you know, journals, some papers, some pictures. Things like that. They'll all be stuffed in water packs, and we're actually going to put them in our suits. We're also taking extra air canisters. We're bringing food in protective bags because apparently we're stopping along the way. I mean, it's a lot to get together, but really, Brennan seems very prepared. And we were prepared too. You know, that's our job. Our job is to be ready, and we can do that. But what we're getting ready for exactly, that we do not know. Brennan goes over the last details and things for our trip and what all he wants to bring. And in the end, everyone gets a role, and we each have a set of items that we're going to take with us. Frank and I will head up the protection for the group, so we'll have some extra weapons, and I brought our underwater zoom goggles. They're great. First of all, they send warnings if there's anything of size around us that's not a member of my team, because we'll all be synced up so our equipment will know that we're all there, and then it will also know if something else is there that shouldn't be. I can also filter out some of the ocean sand and dust in the water and, you know, have a better chance of homing in on something that is heading our direction and give us a small chance of getting a best guess of what it even is. We have some tranquilizer guns built for underwater purposes in case something dangerous is coming after us and it's getting too close. So we're all getting prepared, mentally and with our supplies. As for Brennan, he's mostly concerned right now of what's going to happen in Auckland. Loading the yacht and bringing all that we are, it could raise some eyebrows. You know, he's already been seen and found to be interested in inner Earth, and if anyone gets an idea that he's onto something, it could cause big problems. So we're there to help make sure that they don't. We go over a lot that day. We get organized, we have our plan, and then we're ready to get going. Brennan says he's taken a leave from all of his projects, so hopefully no one that he works with will be looking for him, and that'll give us a little bit of a head start before anyone there, you know, at least get suspicious. We're on a plane the next morning. It's a long flight, but we make it to Auckland. And he was right. I mean, everyone and their mother seems to know this guy there. And in fact, on our way to get our rooms, I noticed someone following us. It's a woman. So I grab a shot of her and run a face recognition on her. And I find out she's from the local news. So I let the group know to keep going. And I just walk right up to her. And, you know, I just need to kill whatever this is right then and there. So I walk up to her and I flat out ask her, you know, why is she following us? And she comes back trying to ask some questions, you know, like, who are we and what's Brennan up to? And I lean over and I just whisper in her ear. You know, I tell her a few things that I'm not going to mention here, but needless to say, she was gone within the next 3 minutes. So we get that done. And we get to where we're going to stay. And we're all about to head up to our rooms and drop off our things. You know, me and my team, we have two suites. And Brennan is staying just down from us in a room by himself. Anyway, Brennan stops us. And he seems to be kind of lost in thought. And he tells us that he's always been drawn to this area, but that he never really knew this was where he was supposed to go, you know, to get back. He just came here to get away. He always felt at peace. And now, here he is. He's back. And this is where he needed to be all along. He never knew that. Anyway, so kind of interesting. He wanted to share that with us. And I'll just fast forward a little bit here because, you know, that night we just had dinner. We got to know each other a little bit better, went over the plans in more detail. We were set to be on the yacht by 8 o'clock the next morning and ready to dive by early afternoon. We will be cave diving in the ocean. And Brennan described it as a journey. He tells us that we won't even realize we're crossing over into the other world until we come out on the inside. When we leave, there are a lot of locals and other travelers that know Brennan that want to get a good look at his yacht and bid him farewell, and they want to know what he's doing. So he just explains us, you know, that we're part of the crew and we're diving guides and that he's meeting another boat full of friends out on the water. And it goes over pretty good. Anyway, 2 hours later, we're finally off and away enough to have some privacy. So we already went over everything and we're all pretty quiet, really. We take a lot of trips to the unknown with the work that we do, but this one feels a little bit different. Can't really pinpoint it yet, but I think we're all feeling it. And then we start to approach the island that we're trying to get to. And it looks more like a couple of giant rocks, you know, with a little bit of green in the middle. And it didn't look like much, although it grew in size the closer we got. Now, the yacht can't get us all the way there, but a few dinghy trips, and we got all of us and our supplies to the shore. The yacht is going to stay put with his crew. He has three members. If there were any issues or anything happens while we're traveling, they have procedures that they're going to follow, but we're assured that they will be there when we return, whenever that is. So we are on the island now, and you know, we're not stopping. There's no break. We're not going to sit down just because you feel like it. We need to keep moving. We all take the gear that we're in charge of, and we head out on foot. We hike for a while, and then around some big rocks. And then we get there, the final rock that we need to climb, and then we are going to climb down inside of it, it's a crack climb, we'll rappel down in the rock until we get to the bottom, where Brennan says will be our takeoff point. Okay, so we get up, in, and down, and there's this little sandy area down there, and we organize all our climbing gear, and we set it off to the side and behind these rocks. And then it's time to change it up. We get into our diving gear. We check everything, and we recheck it. We're all in our suits. We have our special goggles. Frankie and I, you know, have our few extra things like knives. Anyway, we're all set up and it's down in the water we go. We follow Brennan's lead because he has the copy of his map. He sealed it up because he wants to use it underwater. So he stops often to check it, but we're following him. And then eventually we pop up in a cave. And now, just so you know, this little island that we landed on after the yacht, it was not all that big. Not to mention, it was pretty much solid rock. And we've been diving for a while, so we know that we have to be out and beyond it. But where we are, you know, we have no idea. And we ask Brennan, and he just says, you know, we're on our way. And it was during that break when I first noticed something that was different. We had to actually make these makeshift borders around us because there were these crazy crab-looking things down there. Wherever down there was, right? I mean, they weren't like any crabs or anything I'd ever seen before. So we all were getting the feeling that maybe we were starting to transfer over to a new place. But we ate the snacks we brought and we stayed the night. We weren't really sure if it was night though, honestly. I mean, it could have been 4 in the afternoon for all we know, but it was time to rest. And so that's what we did. And when I wake up, Brennan is up and all ready to go. And we get the team ready. And before we know it, we're diving again. After going for a while, my goggle sensors go off. And when I look to my team, they all give me the signal that their sensors are going off too. And it's something large. I can tell that. So Frankie and I kind of move to the sides and we let the rest of the team swim past us. So they're all in front of us now. And we're looking at the perimeters and we're trying to figure out where this thing is. But even with the goggles, we can't see anything around us. But then, out of absolutely nowhere, this thing starts rising towards us from below. And our sensors are going crazy now. And I can see the lights of our team. The rest of the team, they're up ahead of us. So Frankie and I come together and we both have our underwater tranquilizers guns out and ready. But this thing just keeps rising. We can't tell where its head is. This thing is enormous. We can't even tell what it is. But it gets up so high that it actually bumps into us and starts pushing us off to the side. So we float off a ways, and then we can finally see its face. I mean, its face was enormous. Very big, blinking eyes, you know, big features all around. This thing could have swallowed us whole as a group in one gulp, but it didn't. Instead, it turns out this thing was actually friendly. You know, it swam all around us in a circle. Frankie and I went up and joined the others at this point, and we're just watching this thing swim around. It looked like a giant round ball with these big fins. I really wish I could have got a picture of that, but not even Brendan knew exactly what to call it. But you definitely knew at this point, now, that we had definitely crossed over to somewhere. You know, we were not in Kansas anymore, if you know what I mean. That was obvious. This round fish thing finally swam away, and that's about when we started to hit the tunnels. So we passed under and through this rock wall, and then we started going through these small tunnels. But the farther we went, the tighter the tunnels got. And I remember the last one, it got pretty claustrophobic, and it was a pretty tight squeeze for Frankie. And he's, you know, a bigger muscular guy. And it was a really tight squeeze for Brennan. You know, he was just a bigger guy. And we weren't even sure if he was actually going to fit, but he did make it. And so we're all relieved about that. But then we realize what actually happened to Brennan. When he pushed through that last space, a sharp piece of rock cut through his suit and his leg, and he started to bleed. Not a good thing to have happen when you're underwater like that. So immediately, we're all looking around, you know, for sharks or whatever else could be down there. And sure enough, within about 30 seconds, these two larger blue fish swim up on either side of the group. And blood's coming up from Brennan, and it's just all around him. And one of these fish opens their mouth, and like a shark, they had these rows and rows of teeth. But these were not sharks. I mean, they might as well have been, though. Their teeth were super long and super pointy. You know, one chomp and they would just take you out. They would just cut you in half. I had to make a move. So I took out my tranquilizer gun and I shot the first one. And then I shot the other one. But it didn't do anything. In fact, it only got angry. So it swims super fast up to Brennan and it bumps him as it goes by, pushing him to the side. And he's crunched together now like it hurt. But, you know, I don't know and we can't talk to each other. So we all get our guns out and, you know, I, along with Frankie and Harley, we start hitting these guys. But each gun only has 6 shots in it, so I use all of mine. I see that Frankie's out too. And just as Scarlett and Ryder are about to be our backups and start shooting theirs off, the tranquilizers finally kick in. The fish sort of start to float to the side and out a little ways. I mean, they're not completely out, but it appears that they can only swim in spurts. You know, they'll go and then they rest. And they go again and they're kind of spinning around. So we just leave them in a hurry. We need to keep moving. Scarlett and I each take one of Brennan's arms and we help him go forward. And the rest of the guys kind of form a barrier around us, keeping an eye on anything else that might show up. It's slow going, but it turns out we really didn't have too much farther to go. We noticed the water ahead was changing colors. I mean, it was full of colors. It reminded me of the Northern Lights, but it was underwater. It was very cool. The closer that we got to it, the brighter it got. And then we realized we made it. We made it to the inside. And the only way I can describe that moment was it was amazing and strange, invigorating, all at the same time. You really didn't even notice that you were getting anywhere. You know, Brennan was right. You wouldn't have noticed that you were going down or in somewhere. It was just as if we kept diving, going forward through the rocks and tunnels. We had no idea which direction we were actually going. We just followed Brennan's lead. And aside from the odd life that we found down there in the water, you wouldn't even have known anything was out of the ordinary. But anyway, we made it. And we come up and we're in this little pool area, like a natural pool. And there was black rock, tiny black rock, that would be their sand, on this really small beach. And the rest of it around this pool was green, really green. This short but very thick grass of sorts. And so anyway, we get out and we get onto the shore, and there are these two shimmery-skinned women standing there. They each had shorter chocolate brown hair with sort of bigger eyes, and they were dressed kind of alike. As they tend to Brennan's wound, we learn this pool is one of many doorways. And Brennan tells us that each of these channels, as they call them, was unique. That each one also has a set of watchers. So no matter the day or the time, there will always be two people stationed at every channel. He explains that these trips are very important to their well-being and that they are extremely careful. If they were using our terms, they would call these top secret missions. They take all precautions to keep the risk of anyone tracking them and also to avoid any leaks on the other side from happening. And you know, it doesn't go unnoticed by any of us that Brendan knows a lot about what's going on here, and he knows a lot about this place. And we remember that he knows all of this because of the stories that were passed down. I mean, they've obviously done a very good job because sight unseen, Brendan knows the details. It's pretty amazing. Okay, so we're on land and I start looking around. You know, the plants are extra green. And then there's the flowers, you know, if you want to use that word. They all have a glow to them. So whatever color it is, there's a matching glow that's all around them. It was all very vibrant. I think that's the best word for this place. Everything was vibrant. There was zero blah to this place. Everything popped. We get our dive gear off, you know, and everything like that. And, you know, it's not like we packed a bag. So we're wearing what we have on. We have no shoes, no anything other than, you know, our body suits that we had on underneath. I mean, we really stood out. But then a man shows up and he leads us to this other hut, house building thing, and they actually take care of us there. They gave us some clothes, pants, these longer light shirts slash jacket sort of things, very colorful. And while I'm changing, I notice these sounds coming from outside, and it's this echo. And I can hear the waterfalls, the small rivers flowing. It's just all echoes. Because everything's so thick, you know, like the grass and the bushes and the trees, it's hard to tell where it's all coming from. But you can definitely hear them. You know, that's something that we don't have here on the surface. Okay, so we get all changed and everything, and then we start walking. And as we're going, I realize that I haven't seen any sort of cars or anything like that. I don't know where we're going exactly, but apparently we're going to get there on foot, right? So I asked about it, and the young man tells me that they don't use road vehicles there. They don't see it as a necessity since they have legs and feet and animal transportation for things that are the everyday. For long distances, they did have mechanical travel, and it was air travel only, meaning they had vehicles, but they flew through the air. The leaders always traveled this way, if they were going anywhere outside of their little village or city, but others, not so much. I mean, for us, you know, here, we always have the need to get places quickly. You know, I'm a fan of cars, trucks, jeeps, buses, all that stuff, because you actually get to see and do more. But I can tell you also that there's zero pollution down there. They don't use cars and there's no pollution. I could feel it in my lungs. They were tingling with how fresh the air was. Okay, well, we stop in front of another hut slash house and I can see that this one is someone important. The outside has these large gold vases and the sidewalks lined with all this colored walk. I mean, it's really nice. Brendan stops just before we get there. And when I turn to him and I ask him, you know, what is it? He tells me that he knows he's home and his father is inside. The young man nods, acknowledging that he is right, walks up to the front door, and just when he gets there, the door opens. And this was really interesting. So the man standing at the door looked just like Brennan. And, you know, yes, fathers do look a lot like their sons. But what I mean is that they looked almost the same age. Brennan's father left when he was 40. And it's been 30 years. But to look at him, you'd think it'd only been about 10. And later we find out that because there's so much nourishment in the air and their atmosphere, hydration, things like that, it actually slows down your aging, in the physical sense anyway. I mean, if you could have seen Brennan and his father, you'd have thought they were brothers, not father and son. But okay, we are all invited inside and then out back to where his father has some gardens. And we sit at a table. And we start to chat and unload all the items that Brendan had us pack and take with us. You know, the journals, the papers, the pictures, things like that. And there's some personal things that are talked about here that I'm not going to mention, but we all discussed a lot of stuff for quite a while. And then we head into what I guess you would call town. And this is where a lot of people were. So I saw different sorts of beings. You know, some had long necks and long faces. Others had hair so thick, it didn't even seem like hair. I wanted to touch it. You had these dark-skinned beings, and they had extremely blonde hair, almost white. And then you had these light-skinned people, like porcelain white, with hair so black it was almost blue. I saw a lot of intense eyes, you know, bigger eyes that stood out. And I swear, everything just had that luminescence about it. Even the people, the plants, the water, everything. The light down there came from one smaller sun, And it moved in circles, I learned, and in the opposite direction of the rotating Earth. Anyway, it was kind of always out, but they didn't really go by night or day anyway, because there, everyone slept twice a day, not once a day like we do. So it didn't matter if it was light out or not. They would have their time to be up, and then they would sleep, and then they would have another section to be up, and then go back to sleep. And they did this over and over again, shorter shifts, but in the same way we do. We just sleep for a longer time, and we're up for a much longer time. And this got me thinking, you know, how do people work with a schedule like that? So I asked what people do there. You know, did they even have jobs? And Brennan's father, who I'll just go ahead and call him Thatcher, told us that yes, people work, but from what they have learned, their work is different than ours. The only jobs that anyone had there were techie and advanced stuff, things that were only meant to better their world or their minds. One would never waste their day on mundane tasks. And there were no jobs for things that people could just do themselves. For example, no one hired any help for their homes or their property. There would be nobody coming to pick up your waste because these are all things someone can do for themselves. We talked with Thatcher for quite a while. He was very interesting. Brennan was just fascinated with him. You know, now he's a grown man and he can relate to his father better. It was great to watch. And then Thatcher asked about what happened to his wife, Brennan's mother. And that was pretty sad. You know, if Thatcher could have only come back, he could have maybe taken her back with him to this place, and she may not have died of her longtime illness. Thatcher believed that it was us, you know, infecting ourselves with much of our ailments that we get. You know, the way we eat, the way we drink unnecessary things and pollute our world. I mean, I have to say, to meet Thatcher, you're kind of drawn to the guy. The energy he gave out just pulled you in. And when we went on to meet others, it was no different. We're actually taken next to their group of leaders. So it'd be like meeting the president, only this is a group. And they call themselves the Panel of Existence. So in their land, there was not one leader. There was this panel, and they all ruled together. And this is the group that picks and chooses those that will go to the surface, among other important jobs and expeditions. And we learned that Brennan's father was a very important part of society. We also got to find out why he never came back to the outside, to his wife and son. Well, at the time, there were dangers with the outsiders that were trying to get in, and they just kept coming. So the insiders had to close all of their channels. And it was at that point that they made the decision that Thatcher would then just stay. And they also knew that they knew about Brennan, and they knew that it was his generation that was set to return, and they were giving him permission to do that. So they all hoped that one day they would be reunited. And then this part was interesting. So Brennan would be the first half-breed to come back. And the only reason he was actually accepted back was because of the status of his father. They trusted Thatcher. And they wanted to use this as a test that could maybe lead to something later. You know, maybe it could open a window for organized exchanges in the future. They were actually really happy that we were all there. They even said that maybe they would see us again. And I'm not sure exactly what they meant, but I mean, I'd go back there anytime. Visit, do a job for them, whatever they need or want. This job overall turned out to be so different than any other job that we have done. You know, we're not fighting off a ton of bad guys. We're not there to take something. We came prepared. You know, we had different weapons and defenses, but we really didn't even need them, at least not yet. You know, Brennan had no idea what to expect. And, you know, that's why we were brought along. You know, we were there to be there, just in case. Our job was to get him there in one piece and make sure that he made it. That's what he wanted. You know, Brennan just wanted to make sure that he got there safely. And, you know, part of me thinks that maybe he also wanted us there to help him realize that what he was doing was real. You know, he's not going crazy. This was not a dream. We were there in a real place and real things were happening. And we stayed over there for 4 sleep cycles, which, you know, I don't really know what that equals in our time, our days. So maybe it was 2 days, maybe 3, I'm not sure. The food was amazing. You know, they didn't have any seafood because there are no seas down there. We had vegetables, but their vegetables were a little bit different. We always had a protein, but it wasn't meat or anything like soy. It was something unique to their world. I mean, between the food and the air and everything, I pretty much felt like Wonder Woman down there. It was pretty crazy. We were also able to witness their welcome back ceremony. That's what they do for people when they return. And Brennan was able to meet all of the people that his father had known his whole life. And they were so welcoming, it was like he had been there the whole time. And then while they were conducting the ceremony, you know, we all couldn't help but notice the large book that one of the leaders was speaking from. It was bigger than your average book, that's for sure. And it was gold. So when the ceremony was over, you know, we asked Brennan what that was all about. And he let us see it up close. It was closed, and the outside was literally made of gold, and it really shined bright. Brennan told us that this book was called The Existence. And that's just how they saw things. You know, things existed. That's why the leaders group was called the Panel of Existence. Same thing. They didn't view life and death the same we do. Everything just exists in their world. The book, The Existence, could almost be compared to what some call the Bible here in our world. It held the stories of inner Earth's origins and purpose. Brennan said it also holds the answers to things like extinction, the greatest ideas, and possibly even our ancestors. I mean, I wanted to see that book. I wanted to open it and see what was inside of it, but that was a no-go. The panel was the keepers of the book. It was their job to read the stories as they were, and then the others were to tell the stories to their families and down through the generations to keep them alive. I did get to touch the book, though, and when I ran my fingers down its spine, I felt a little chill or some kind of energy zip through me. And that was our last event, I guess you could call it, of being on Inner Earth. Brennan was home. He made it in one piece, barely. He would now stay with his father, and his first project and involvement would be the exchange of information. He had a lot to tell them, and he had a lot to learn. As for us, our job was complete, and it was time for us to go. And leaving that place was a little different than pretty much any place I'd ever left, because you really don't have the chance to come back. I mean, I know they said that they might see me again, and maybe that's true, but it's not like you can decide that it's time to go back or there's a lot of people going there all the time and you can maybe hitch a ride. It felt really final. So it was, you know, there were a lot of emotions going around about that. We bid our farewell, though, and we left the same way that we got there. Brennan gave me his map. He had waterproofed it, and I would use that on our way back and just we'd follow it backwards. And so we went. You know, we stayed in the same place to rest, and we finally came up on that rock island. And with all of that behind us, there we were, found ourselves climbing that wall and returning to the yacht. And when we got to Kerry Kerry, it seemed that people had spotted Brennan's boat. So our little idea of coming back to a different place so that we would not be noticed really did not work. But we all agreed that we would say nothing. The crew on the yacht, they were there to get supplies, and then they continued on their way to wherever they were going, but they didn't talk to anyone either. By the time we got to Brennan's private jet, we had a small crowd following us, but we never gave them an answer as to where Brennan was or what this expedition was. You know, first off, it was our job to keep that secret, and secondly, they didn't deserve to know. You know, after being down in our other world, it really makes you think and wonder, how much farther along could we all be if we didn't let things like greed and envy and selfishness get in our way? You know, they move as a group, and we move as individuals. Don't get me wrong, because I like my life just the way it is, but it was very interesting to see things from a different perspective. You know, that's part of what made this job so moving. Okay, well, we get back and we stop back in San Diego, actually, because we have items to pick up that we left there that we didn't take with us on this trip. And we see that his home is already for sale. You know, Brennan was a very quiet guy. He kept to himself a lot, but there's still going to be quite a few people that are going to wonder what happened to him. If you didn't know him, you won't even realize he was here. When we gather up all our items and we're ready to go and head out, Brennan's entire staff, you know, the chef, he had a waiter, a driver, they all line up to see us off. And you know that they know. They know he's gone and that he's not coming back. And as for us, we get back home and it's back to normal life, you know. It's time for me to check in and find out what new jobs are waiting for me. And that was it. That was my job, escorting one man to his beginning, to his home, to the inside, as he would call it. Episode 2, Inner Earth and the Secrets That Threaten This Beautiful World. The job I'll be talking about today has to do with a place that I had been to before. Some time had passed since I and the team helped one man get back to his inner home, his inner earth, and he has called on me again. The secrets to all he collected on how to get to inner earth, what works, and the dead ends we are chasing got into the wrong hands. It was set to be destroyed upon his departure, but now has come back as a threat. He needs someone he can trust to not only go in and get what he needs, but to deliver it to where it belongs. They call me the Ghost. I'm ex-CIA and now a dark operative on the dark web. I've worked a lot of jobs, and today is my account of what happened when helping one man still trying to reach his true freedom at home where he belongs and be released from the world above and protect the secrets that keep his home safe. Take a listen and enjoy. This request was unlike any other request I'd gotten at the time, not because it had to do with something outrageous, because so many do, not because I had to decide what the right thing to do was, and not because it was something I'd never heard of before. It was because I was overcome with a feeling to protect, a feeling of obligation. So many of the things I get involved in, and that me and my team do, you know, they have to do with protecting what is right, protect a person, keep someone safe, or keep the world itself from being hit by something so wrong that it would change us forever. There's so many decisions to make, each and every time. You know, you guys hear about the jobs we do, but I can't stress enough what the real process is behind it all and the tough decisions we have to make. Now, this request, we knew we were going to do. It had to do with a place, a man, and a world we got to know before. They're not violent, they're not invasive, and they're not a threat. But as like we have seen with other jobs, and as you can probably see just being out there, the people living in the world we all live in can be invasive, and we can be a threat, not only to others, but to each other, to our friends, just as much as we can to our enemies. People walk around thinking they're all good when really they're just out for themselves, and that is what drives it. That is the biggest threat of all. And that's what we're dealing with here. What also stood out to me with this request was where it came from. I knew it immediately. I didn't get it from the dark web, which is where people find me. And speaking of, I know some of you have been interested in knowing, you know, how would you find me even if you do know how to navigate the dark web? Well, my information is really exclusive to my network. You would have to know how to find someone like me or something like this. And you only get that information if you have a connection somewhere. So, you know, you don't just look me up and order your service, you know, like Amazon or something. There are only so many requests one can review and accept. But okay, this request was in the network, but it did not come over the dark web, and I knew immediately where it originated from. Let me start at the beginning. So with our lives, you know, me and my team, it's not like we typically have the two-week vacation that people get. You know, you're in the grind, but then you get released from it, you know, for a few days or a little bit of time, and we take what we can get. Can't do this forever, you know, and this is our mission right now. So the jobs take precedence over many things. But when we can, we do sneak off to do something for ourselves. And we were on a mini break, I guess you'd call it. And we flew over to Porto Heli, that's in Greece if you don't know, where we ate great food and went on some dives, just to, you know, clear our heads, take that break. And it was great. 2 days in, you know, we're all settling in for all of this, I have to say, awesome sunset dinner. And this young waiter comes to our table. He doesn't say anything. I'm just looking up at him, and he sort of puts his head up and he closes his eyes and he faces the small bit of sun that is left. You know, it's purposeful. And when he does that, I see the shimmer. There's this shimmering effect that I can see on his cheeks and his neck. We can all see it. You know, he's facing the sun, so we're all just sitting there, and no one's saying anything, and we're just a little put back by it all. And then he opens his eyes, and he looks directly at me, and then to everyone else, and it hits us hard. His eyes are that green. That's the green we know from Inner Earth. The shimmer on his skin is what we know from Inner Earth. Now, you might not notice anything strange about him right away, but we know better. This man was from Inner Earth. And just in case you still haven't listened to that first vlog, let me give you just a little bit of the background. So Brennan, who was my requester at that time, was contacted by his father and told that it was time for him to come home to Inner Earth. We found out that there are inners that come and stay up top with us. You know, they do exist with us. They need to because we're on the outside. You know, we surround them and we are everything that protects them. Our side of the earth is their outer layer of protection. but we can still also be a threat with our abuse to the planet, our never-ending searches to find their world. And they need people out here so that they can bring information back to the inside so they can be prepared for anything coming their way. And Brennan was the one that told us all about their skin, the slight shimmer, and the eyes. He told us all about it. And again, you have to look for it. You know, if you saw it, you might just brush it off. And that's exactly how he knew he was being contacted by someone from his home when they were delivering him the message. Okay, well, back to this request then, where we now have this young man. And I mean, he couldn't have been more than, I'd say, 21 or 22. And he was showing us his shimmer. I mean, he wanted us to see it. He wanted us to know who he was. He looked directly at us. He wanted us to see his eyes. And knowing he made that connection, he unclips this letter-sized envelope from the clipboard that he's holding. But before he does anything with it, he looks back at the sun, and then he looks at all of us, and then directly at me. And then he hands me the envelope. He then just takes a step back, lowers his head to us, and then turns and walks off. Now, as we also learned before, that's really how they operate. If you know about them, you know. If you're one of them, you know about each other, but you don't call attention to yourselves. You don't really interact. They do that so that they don't end up standing out. You know, each one of them that's here has their own mission independent of each other, but they're all here for the same cause, to learn and use the knowledge to protect themselves and maintain their lives back home. Okay, well, we're sitting there. It's pretty incredible. You know, we're just contacted in a random place. You know, they knew where to find us. And now we have this envelope. You know, so we stop what we're doing, pick up the envelope, and I open it. And inside is a letter written on this same yellow paper that Brennan had showed us the last time. There's also a map and some other information. And anyway, I have a copy of the letter right here, so let me just read it to you. It says, "Hello, Ghost. If you are reading this, then the first part of this mission is complete. I can't stress to you enough how the help you gave previously worked out in so many ways. And I humbly ask for your help again. You said at that time that you'd be willing, and I hope you still are. When I left certain documents behind, research from my life on top. There was only so much I could take with me, and these documents were to be destroyed by a loyal confidant, but they were not. On top of that, my father wants them. They need to be wiped from the outside and brought to us so they can be reviewed and stored. Should they stay up top in the now my friend turned adversary's hands, it could destroy us." And then it's signed, Brennan. And he goes on then to explain what all happened and more about what this situation is. And that's all in the other papers that were also in this envelope. And I mean, you might just think, you know, let's just download it all, destroy it, and send the information back with someone who's already going. But it's not that simple. You know, yes, there are always people coming to the top and others heading down in a constant rotation, but this is highly classified for them. They can't stir up a panic with the inners as a whole. You know, sound familiar? I mean, unlike us, though, this group, you know, these people, they really do, or how they impressed me was, mean to only do good. They would not keep secrets for power and control over their people. They keep what they can from the people in order to keep the harmony. If this did turn out to be a threat, if it got to that level, they would for sure let everyone know. It's a little different than how we do things up top. You know, hey, it's kept them the way they are. You know, it's working. Well, anyway, so we're sitting there in beautiful Greece. But that's how the job goes, right? Now we have this job before us. And we always know that really we're sort of always on call because although we don't always need to take requests, we can turn them down. Some just can't be ignored. Well, then our real waiter comes over with our food and breaks all train of thought. And, you know, we're sitting on this awesome patio with a view of the boats that have docked for the night. We have our food. The sun's going down. I mean, it's perfect. And, you know, mind you, we don't actually get many breaks. I mean, sometimes one or a few of us will take a day or two, you know, maybe a few to get away. But to have us all there, you know, we do what we can. But the time's hard to get. Anyway, this was one of those times, but our break was now over. We do eat, though. You know, we finish up the last few moments of what we have going on. We don't break out any more of the information that Brennan has sent to us in public. We save it for when we get back to our rented villa. And what we find when we do get into it is pretty informative. It would have to be, you know, in order for us to do anything about it. So what happened, really? I'm just going to sum it up for you. So when Brennan left, again, what's in that first vlog, there was only so much he could bring back, like he says. And something he did not bring were these more personal logs and information that he had gathered over time. It wasn't supposed to go anywhere. No one was supposed to see it. He did it for himself, just to keep himself busy and to keep his dream of going home to Inner Earth alive. He logged where portals to Inner Earth were thought to be and all about our hunt to find them, the excursions that he went on to follow us trying to get in. And he kept different theories, documenting all of it. It was his way of trying to connect to the world from which he came. It was a personal log to him and nothing more. And when it was time to go, he left it behind along with the rest of his life. He didn't need it now. He was going home, where all the information already was. And he had it mixed in with a bunch of other stuff that was set to be destroyed by a man that worked for him. Remember, Brennan was a wealthy man, and he had a lot of people working for him, for professional reasons and otherwise. I was fortunate enough to meet his home crew and his yacht crew, but that was it. You know, none of those guys were who he was talking about. Because he tells us of a man, who I'm going to call Harrison, who was his main personal guy. Brennan referred to him as his confidant and sort of personal assistant. And although he never told Harrison his full story, right, he told Harrison that he was done with regular life, he was going to take his money and run, go enjoy the rest of his days. And in exchange for some pretty sweet benefits, he asked Harrison to dispose of the things he was walking away from, and Harrison promised that he would take care of things. I mean, Brennan had routed all of his money where he wanted that to be, but his home in California had to be sold, which we saw was happening when we got back the first time. He was leaving all that money to be made to Harrison. Same with his condo in New York. His yacht went to his captain and stuff like that, you know. But then there was all of the accumulated paperwork, files, clothes, and other things. You know, all of that other little stuff. Brennan wanted any of his clothes or home goods and things to be donated, and everything else was to be destroyed. And Harrison agreed. He would just take care of it. And Brennan trusted him. He had no reason not to. And Harrison did take care of things, for the most part. Turns out Harrison did not sell the condo in New York. In fact, he still has it, and he went through all of Brennan's things. All of his information, files, personal documents. And then he kept one thing that he should not, and he can't be left to have. Brennan's book of maps. Apparently, leaving Harrison the profits, you know, from his home and condo. Oh, yeah, and he left him his all-paid-for sports car, too. Apparently, that wasn't enough. He was looking for Brennan's secrets, you know, his secrets to success. But instead, he found what he did, the book. Then he put it all together. He didn't know exactly if Brennan was from there, but he did know of his interest in Inner Earth. Everyone did. He was always looking into it in the excursions that everyone was taking to try to find Inner Earth. I mean, he could only guess. And Harrison thought this was his big chance, his map to success, literally. He'd find Inner Earth, and he would be a hero. Well, this situation now needed to be handled. Brennan needs someone to clean this up and get this taken care of, for real, and then deliver the goods to Brennan and his father, Thatcher, who has very high status in Inner Earth. We need to find Harrison, find out where he's hiding this book of maps, and then steal it back for Brennan and his people. And I mean, how did Brennan find out about all of this in the first place? Well, I don't want to spend too much time in the vlog explaining all of that in detail, but basically, a computer repair guy finds a disc in Harrison's computer that's revealing a ton of these pictures. They're all taken of Brennan's maps. You know, and he asks Harrison, hey, what are these? And Harrison leaks that they're maps to a great treasure that he was going to find. And after he tells him that, he immediately kicks the guy out. But it turns out that the computer guy was a fellow Inner Earther. They didn't know Harrison or where the physical maps would be, but they knew one of the entry points because they had taken it and they knew this was bad. They got the information home to their leaders, who found the connection to Brennan, and so on. Well, they didn't want to have one of their own going and snooping around up top, risking them getting caught and then possibly discovered. And that's when Brennan thought of me and my team, and here we are. He said the book was very well hidden amongst the items to be disposed of, so this good friend of Brennan's must have really been looking for something good to find it. And we needed to find this guy. He was part of Brennan's New York gang, and so that's where we were headed. And long story short there, we find the book. It's in Brennan's condo, you know, of course, because now Harrison's living there, in a floor safe. Took us a while, and we did have to pull some moves to keep the guy out of the place while we got into everything. But this vlog really isn't about a break-in, you know, but we did get the book, And then we certainly didn't need to keep it or hold on to it. So we really had no reason to wait. We needed to get it to Inner Earth and get it to Brennan. Now, the last time me and my team traveled to the inside, we all went. And we were going to do that again. That trip was when we were securing Brennan's journey to help guarantee that he actually got there. You know, his world was this natural, thriving place where everything seemed to make sense. You know, everything seemed to actually mean more there than they do in our average lives here. We dove off the Bay of Islands off New Zealand and entered the water here and came out over there in this new and beautiful place. With this request or call for help, we take notice that Brendan has a new way for us to travel this time. This time, we won't be setting out from the Bay of Islands, but instead it appears our entrance is a cave in Belize. Because we were noticed the last time, you know, being seen with Brennan, because everyone knew who Brennan was, you know, people were interested in us. They wanted to know what was going on. And he doesn't want us going to the same place to be recognized again, because then people are going to start to wonder all over again, what's up with Brennan? You know, where we're going, he says there shouldn't be anyone. Brennan's notes tell us we need to get through a cave first, and then we will sort of take this dive. It's not a regular dive. He's provided all the details around all of that so that we can be prepared. We get what we need for our travels, pack it all up, and before we know it, we're in Belize. And I can't tell you exactly where we land, where we go to, but I can tell you that we took a boat in. Yep, we loaded everything into these two actually large canoes. And so, you know, this place isn't advertised, it's not a tourist thing or anything, and Brennan was right, there is no one around. And just like Brennan told us, we were able to take our boats and float on in. And you know, we're not moving too fast or anything, and it's a pretty tight squeeze. There were times, you know, that we didn't have a ton of room above us or around us. But again, Brennan had all the information laid out for us, and we knew what to do. We knew what would fit, if not barely. And this cave ride, I guess, was actually pretty cool. There were some roots breaking through and just a lot of rock all around you, large draperies hanging down. And we were to just make our way until we came upon a group of these symbols on the cave walls. That would be our mark to stop. And, you know, funny thing about these symbols is that, you know, if we as people, you know, here found those, came upon those, discovered them, you know, they'd be researched and they'd try to date them back and try to find out which one of our historical civilizations they belong to. But, you know, they'd never know that they were carved by Inner Earthers that were traveling here. But we know. We know those symbols were put there as guides. Well, we find them and then we stop. We get our boat situated so that it doesn't go anywhere and we unload. We take a quick break to fuel up, you know, get something to eat, get some water, and do a check of our supplies and things that we have attached to our bodies. They're attached in waterproof bags because we know we'll be going into the water. The next part of this trek, though, is going to take a while. It's on foot, and we have a ways to go, so our break isn't very long before we get moving again. We have our headlamps, we have good shoes, caving suits, all the stuff that we need, and we each also have our food and supplies. We have little oxygen tanks. They're smaller ones because apparently it won't be underwater very long, says Brennan. And then his directions tell us to follow these symbols. That's how we know where to go. The rest of them aren't just on the walls so easy to see. You have to kind of look for them in cracks in the rocks and things. It felt like, you know, you were kind of solving a puzzle or something, that we were looking for clues, you know, which we essentially were. We had some fun with it, actually, as we went forward. One thing that we found more of when we got out of the boat that we didn't love was bats. There were lots of bats in there, fruit bats, but still. I mean, Frankie and Jagger didn't love it. Scarlet, Ryder, Harley, and I definitely didn't love it. But still, the cave is cool. We had to hike until we found this one rock. And when we found it, we'd know because it was shaped kind of funny. It would stand out. And then we take a turn and we head down. And we go down and around for quite a while. I mean, we went way down there. It wasn't easy and it wasn't roomy. There were some tighter squeezes, especially if Frankie had a harder time getting through, but we did make it. And that next stop was the water hole. It was perfectly round and it was illuminated. We had no idea how, but it was. It was the first natural light, if you could call it that, that we had seen since we got in there, right? Because there's no light that can get in. But this thing was lit up and it was very light blue. And then it had this sort of white mist floating above it. There were two of these things all together, one to get you there to inner earth and one to get you back. We're, of course, at the one that takes us out. And, I mean, we're ready to tackle this thing. We are a little beat up from the hike down because it's kind of tight. Like I said, lots of rock edges. You know, we did have our suits on, which protected us from cuts and things. But, you know, I was betting I was walking out of there with some bruises. Anyway, we lean in. We take a little bit of a closer look at this water hole. And like Brennan told us that it would be, the water was swirling. Now, according to him, and to do this, we do have to take his word, this thing would suck us up right into his world. So we're just all standing around this thing. And then we look at each other, and this was actually pretty funny because, I mean, I'm almost laughing right now thinking about it because Ryder just starts laughing. I mean, this doesn't happen too often like this, but it does happen, and it happened this time. I mean, she just starts laughing, and then she just says to all of us, you know, we're crazy. And it just hit all of us just right, you know, and we all break out laughing. You know, that kind of laugh where you just can't stop. That's what we were doing. You know, we're standing there in this crazy cave by this lit up pool. You know, we're in the middle of who knows where. And I'm standing there, I'm holding this map. And just for some reason, it all just hit us. It was hilarious. You know, we are pretty crazy to do any of the stuff we do. But we eventually did stop that madness. And we got it together so that we could keep moving. Okay, so we each have two mini scuba tanks for our oxygen. One for the way there and one for the way back. And we have this special setup for those. And I can try to explain that. It's a cap and everything is attached to that and strapped down. I've used them before and they work great. And Brennan warned us of high speed, so we came prepared. Once these things are on, they aren't going anywhere. So after we get our suits on, yep, we have wetsuits that we brought with us. We strapped them to our backs on our way in, and we had to squeeze into those, cave suits and all. You know, we had put our caps on and our tanks on to secure them. I mean, everything had to stay with us because we couldn't leave anything behind. Anyway, we get everything put on over what we already had on, get everything secured, and then we're ready. And now we're just standing around this pool. And around this pool, there were these round rocks. So we have this perfect circle, light blue pool with these perfectly round, smooth rocks, you know, around the edge. There were five of them. According to Brennan, we were to each take a seat on a rock and then let ourselves slide right in, and then the water would do the rest. I mean, interesting way to end our travels here, but it had to be done. And Brennan said it would be over fast, so we had that going for us. I would go with Ryder, Harley, and Jagger. And then once we were in, Frankie and Scarlett would drop in. And so that's what we did. I trust the situation. We all do. So we don't even think about it. We just do it, like so many of the other things that we've done. And that's how that went. So when you first drop in, you notice that the water isn't cold. You know, it should be being where it is, but it isn't. And you get in, and at first you feel like you've jumped into any pool. But instead of having that urge to float back to the top, well, before you can even have that urge, you're being pulled down. At first, you feel the slight pull of you going down, and it's gentle, but then it gradually picks up, and it picks up speed until you're going, I don't even know how fast. It was like going down a super speed, straight shot, giant water slide. You know, I just folded my arms across my chest, crossed my legs, and went with it. And Brennan said that, you know, because we're passing through from the outside to the inside, the distance wouldn't match the time, and it would only be about 5 minutes. And he was right, because it went very fast. You know, it went so fast that you lost any sense of up or down or anything else. And then all of a sudden, it's like someone put the brakes on, and you're floating, and the light's coming from above. We're all shot out into this calm water, and then we swam to the top. And the closer to the top we got, the lighter green the water got. And then we pop up, and sure enough, we can tell that we've made it. This portal pool, which they actually call channels, was a little different than the last one. I mean, there was green everywhere. Again, it seems like that's a given around this place. But instead of all the rock, there were a lot of flowers. It was all flowers, bright pink ones, yellow ones, you know, that bordered this pool. And then there was this really tall grass, not like a tall lawn, you know, it wasn't thick. There were little patches of it in between the flowers, you know, already. You know, just by popping up out of the water, we're taken back and reminded of just how cool this place is. We spot the beach, which we learned last time is our final landing spot, and so we head that way. And instead of two women being there to greet us, because they always have two people stationed at each channel 24/7 looking out for travelers. Well, today we have one woman and a young man. Well, he looked about 17, but you know, they age slower down there in inner earth, so who would really know? They help us get out of the water, and I just stop for a moment and I listen for those inner earth echoes that I remember from the last time, and I just take it all in. And then I take in this big breath of that awesome clean air, and I could just feel it in my lungs. Like I said before, it just tingles. Well, we're taken over to a little hut again where we get out of our suits and we get the colorful clothes. We all have our waterproof bags with us and things that are strapped to our bodies, and we keep those, but we ditch everything else for now. And we tell them that we're there to see Brennan. And they tell us that he's already notified that station to be on the lookout for us, and they can take us where we need to go. And in case you missed the first log, again, they pretty much travel everywhere on foot. They don't use road vehicles. They don't think it's necessary when they can walk everywhere, and it causes pollution. They also use animal transportation for the things that they need to do. And if you were to go anywhere far away, you would take to the air, and they had these unique vehicles for that. The leaders, they were the only ones that always traveled by air if they were going anywhere outside of their little village or city. So anyway, we'll be walking. There's another man there, and he's going to be our guide. And we all get introduced, and it's off we go. We don't take the main road out, though. Instead, we dip into the, I guess you'd call it a jungle. It's a little bit different than what we think of when we think of a jungle. Everything's super bright, and it has this extra clean look and feel to it. The ground isn't full of sticks and rocks and dirt and things. Instead, there's this green moss-like cover on the whole thing. It's soft, but it's not fragile. You know, it's tough and durable. You know, you're not going to hurt it by walking on it. But it's all green. Anyway, there's this little green path, and it's not very wide, so we follow our guide single file, and we go for a while until we come out just up from a village. Small village. We walk down into it, and I notice there aren't really many people around. And our guide explains that people right then were just getting up from a sleep cycle. They sleep twice a day for shorter amounts versus how we sleep once a day for longer. So anyway, it's a time of day we could probably compare it to morning, maybe, you know, when there's a few people up earlier to beat the rush hour, you know, there are just less people around at the moment, but they're coming out little by little. We're walking through the place, and it looks to me like a big farmer's market or something. You know, there are buildings of sorts, but there are stands everywhere. Fruits, vegetables, all kinds of stuff. They don't use money there, the guide explains. And no, this is nothing even close to socialism, so let's not go there. But it was a system that worked for them. You know, they worked together just to have everything function. You helped your neighbor. They all had things that they contributed to the community. Food, clothing, building, all the services. You know, and typically, one would follow their father or mother in their careers, if you want to label it that. And everything just ran very smoothly. Anyway, more and more people start coming out as we walked through town. And, you know, again, they're beautiful people. You know, smooth, tanned, and smoothed porcelain white skin. Great hair, we all would envy. You know, Vogue would have a heyday down there. But the funny thing is, down there, you know, something you just really couldn't help noticing was that everyone was just friendly and nice, you know, no matter how they looked. There was nothing snotty or uppity about them. Everyone says hello to you with a smile on their face. There's no road rage type of stuff. There's no super stressed people running around in a hurry. You know, I felt kind of like this is how people are supposed to be, you know. But somehow, up top, the people got ruined somewhere along the way. You know, people taking these random paths in life for the wrong reasons and having all this urgency for no reason. Kind of made you sad to think that our lives are like that compared to this. But it's how life is. And in the end, it was just nice, I guess, to know that this type of thing could exist somewhere. Okay, well, we get across town and we turn and head down this other road. And we pass what seems to be some kind of park. You know, there are these giant tree swings with these kids swinging on them. There was a stream and there were people filling up these buckets with water, carrying them back into town. And then there were these giant mushrooms. I loved these things. They were bright yellow. They were big. You know, they're oversized. They were big enough for someone to sit on. And there was this area just full of them. And there were these little inner earth kids just playing on them. You know, they would bend them down and climb onto the tops and bounce on them and lean them from side to side, you know, rock them. And when they did that, you could see the golden, glittery underside of these things. They were super cool. And they'd swing on them. And once they really got going, you know, the kids would try to hold on. And they were falling off. It was fun to watch. So anyway, I'm watching that. And once we get past that, you know, we stop. And I look up and there's this sort of long path to the right that goes up to this hut. They all seem to have these hut-type houses and buildings. You know, more sturdy than what you might think of when you think of a hut. But the way they're constructed, that's just the word that comes to mind. You know, take a small grass hut and then try to envision it more house-like. You know, that's what it was like. The walls were sturdy. The tops were made of these large blades of grass that, interestingly enough, even when dried, they didn't turn brown here. It's like the people, you know, not aging the same. I mentioned last time how Brennan's father was gone 30 years, you know, back in Inner Earth by the time Brennan caught up to him, but it looked like he'd only aged maybe 10. And what I learned this time is that people never really got that, you know, old look, you know, the really old look. I mean, these people here were not vain in any way, but it just worked out for them that, you know, brittle hair and sunspots and saggy skin, it just really wasn't the thing down here. You know, the air was so good and the water was so pure. They didn't indulge in things that were of no use to their bodies. And I can tell you, it showed. I mean, everything down there was similar to our life, but then always at the same time, very different to how we are up top, you know, on the outside. Anyway, this hut, our guide tells us, is where we're going to find Brendan. Then he takes off, and we're left there to walk up to the place. And it was nice, you know, not quite as impressive as his father's, but then again, neither was his ranking, even though he was still connected, you know, and had status in a very important way. Blue and white was the theme he had going on. The path up to the house from the road was all white rock. And, I mean, if you haven't caught on here, there's no pavement in this place. There's no need for it. You walk, you use animals. None of it needs to be done on pavement. The white rock that he had, you know, up to his house was this sparkling rock. You know, we would never think of using that for a walkway, you know, like that to a house. But somehow down there, it worked. Everyone there wore softer shoes. You know, again, there was really no need for anything hardcore. The front door is blue. There are white flowers around the frame. And to the right and left, there were these large planter pots. And they had these blue flowers in them. And not flowers, you know, like you'd think of. Just like all things, everything's a bit off, you know, from what we know. And we get up to the house, and Harley and I actually walk over to them because they were so interesting. They were, I guess you'd say, active. They didn't have a ton of petals, but the petals were puffy. And although their color was a dark royal blue, they were translucent. And they were emitting this mist. And like everything else, they had a luminescence about them. Harley put her finger to one of the petals, and it bounced, and then this stronger puff of mist came out. I mean, if you had one of these at your work desk, you would get nothing done. You know, that's how it was. It was just, you just wanted to touch it and look at it. Well, we had enough flower time, you know, but how can you help yourself, right? And then we regrouped and we went to knock on the door. But before we do that, Brennan opens it, you know, before we even have the chance. And you could tell that he was different. I can't say it was his hair, you know, or anything like that. He was just different. He welcomes us with open arms. A much more relaxed Brennan compared to the man that we met in California. You know, not that he was overly stressed or high-strung, but he was just more relaxed all around now. He tells us how excited he is that we came and he can't thank us enough. And he actually gives each of us a hug. And then he says we have to go. We need to go find his father, who's actually meeting with the panel of existence as we speak. And as I said in my last vlog, they don't have just one leader like a president or a king. They have this panel of existence. And it sort of explains itself once you've been to this place. You know, you either exist or you don't. And the panel works to help maintain and support your best life. They have practices and beliefs that they pass down from one generation to the next. You know, they're the ones in charge, but they don't rule exactly. They just help make sure that their way of life continues. But anyway, that's where we're headed, to the home base of the panel of existence. So I guess if you were in the U.S., this would be like walking to the White House, you know. It was impressive. It was the only actual, you know, building, you know, like we would think of that I saw down there. And I thought it was a strange coincidence that it was also white. So interesting. On the inside of this place, there was a lot of gold with a lot of red and white accents. You know, flowers, tapestries. It was beautiful and it was big and open. It was definitely the nicest place I'd seen so far. And as we're walking in, we're met by a man who asks us to follow him. And he takes us to Thatcher, who isn't with the rest of the panel at the moment. He's alone. But remember, Thatcher is Brennan's father who's on this panel. So we step into this room. And again, we notice how open it is. You know, it's inside, but outside. The walls don't go all the way to the ceiling. And that's how it is all the way around. So you still have this sense that you're in the beautiful world that you're in. I mean, really, aside from personal homes and areas, everything was kind of like that. They believed that a connection to nature is what keeps people going and true to what drives us. And it's clearly working for them. That's all I can say. But we walk in and there are three chairs. I take one, Scarlett takes one, and Frankie takes the other one. And Jagger, Ryder, and Harley, they gather around us while Thatcher takes a seat behind this desk and Brennan pulls up a chair next to him. I tell Thatcher that I have what he's asked for. I let him know we didn't go through any of it because it belongs to them. And remember, I've met Thatcher before. The guy's a rock. You know, he's loyal, smart, and a leader, and he's nice. You can't help but like and admire the guy. I tell him and Brennan that we respect their world and we understand their need to protect it. And I want him to know that we come in a genuine way. We have no ulterior motives here. We aren't even going to take payment for this job. You know, we would refuse it because it's a gift for us to be able to go there. We were fortunate to have the chance more than once at this point. And we were honored to have the chance to help defend a world that's actually working. I would never turn that down or walk away. It's a people that should exist, and I want to help them. So I stand up and I walk around the desk and I hand him the Book of Maps. And this book is actually pretty cool. He's got leather on the outside. You know, he probably got it at an art store or something, but it still has a feel about it because of how he's written and drawn everything inside. You know, it's sort of like a sketch journal because he has drawings in there. He's written things in there. Anyway, it's pretty neat. Anyway, I assure Thatcher and his son, Brennan, that all electronic copies and everything else have been wiped. My Seek and Destroy software tracked it, found it on Harrison's computer in a private folder, and then on that disk. It had never been printed. And in the end, you know, we got it all. And after pulling the real documentation from the safe in Brennan's house, you know, the book, no one else has seen it. And it was a relief for all of us to deliver this. And it felt good to know that we really did save an incredible group of people from a potential invasion from the wrong people. Thatcher took the book and he looks through it. And I mean, he takes his time while I take my seat back across from him. He's looking through it. And after a while, he starts to tear up. You know, he wipes his eyes and then he looks over to Brennan, his son, when he's all done. And we're still sitting there, you know, waiting in silence. But he tells us that this book shows a passion, that his son had a dream of coming home and he stuck to it. And this book is proof of that. It shows Thatcher how much his son's inner side lives within him. It's a realization that this book that Brennan thought was maybe nothing was actually something special. Thatcher tells Brennan that he sees him as a true inner Earthian. Because if you don't know, if you didn't listen to vlog one, Brennan is a half-breed. He's the first half-breed to come back. But Thatcher tells him that he's made it. And by arranging for this book's safety and being forthcoming, he might have just saved their entire world. Because who knows what could have happened, right? The book was definitely in the wrong hands. And then something happened that was surprising to us and that meant a lot. Thatcher gives each of us a medallion and it's hanging on a string. And I'm looking at it and it's the same symbol that I saw on Brennan's bracelet the last time, the one that his father, Thatcher, gave him as a small child. This medallion had an eye on it, and the eye had these long lines coming off the corners, and this eye floated above a circle with these swirls coming in and out of it. And I'm looking at this thing, and I remembered that Brennan told me what all of that meant. And what it meant was, may you always be present in your peace and prosperity. Well, Thatcher tells us that anyone fighting for good like we have done is vulnerable. And he wants to give us these medallions as a representation of our strength and tells us, you know, may we always remember why we need it. I mean, he was trying to send these back with us so that they would protect us. His thanks and appreciation were overwhelming. And then he gets up and asks us to follow him. You know, we head down the hall towards the back of the building and we enter this large room. And these walls are smooth and yellow. They're different than all the other rooms and things we've seen so far anyway. And these walls did go to the ceiling, but there was this large opening in the ceiling covered with what looked like some type of glass. So you could see through it. The natural light came in and shone down, you know, on all the red flowers that were potted every 5 feet or so. And then hanging on the walls in between these flower pots were these large paintings. And then there was this large table in the middle, and the rest of the panel was lined up in front of it. And we stopped when we met up with them, and they each walked up to us one at a time, and they actually shook our hands, lowering their heads in acknowledgement of us as they did that. And they all said thank you. So we all, you know, we put our medallions on around our necks, and we nod back to them. And then Thatcher starts walking around the room, explaining that the paintings are of different marks of time. One was of a time very early on, of the Great Volcano, they called it. When a volcano, also an inner earth, but out a ways from where they were, almost took them out, but they were spared. One is of the first member of the panel, the man who started the idea of it all, and the process of building this group to help keep things running smoothly. Another was the first full panel ever put together. I mean, the paintings told a story of their hard times and their successes, and it felt good that they shared that with us. I mean, this wasn't a welcome to meet the panel, you know, with fireworks and a big party. I mean, this was a very low-key sort of thing, and you just could feel the wisdom in the room. You know, these guys knew what they were doing. They were very, very careful with their world. And it was great to be able to meet them in person and to have been able to do something good for them. Well, anyway, after all that, we're invited to a special dinner that evening where we enjoyed good food, great company. We met more people and parts of their families. And then we were offered accommodations. And we took that sleep cycle and we crashed hard, as you can imagine. We were all done. And then it was time for us to go. And Brennan led us to our exit point. And really, it was a lot like when we came in, you know, except you were just sucked back. And we ended up in a different part of that big cave, the same one that we came through to get there. And before we left, Brennan told me that he would be in touch and that our relationship with them is solid. And no one on the panel sees this as the end. He wanted me to know that. They need people that they can count on the outside, up top. And we have proven our loyalties twice. And anyway, after that, we were off. And it was kind of nice, actually, being shot back to Bailey's, I have to say, because we weren't just shot back into hard society, you know? It was a nice buffer before we got home, to be in the jungle, you know, and in nature. You know, when I left there, got home, I just couldn't really see or imagine my relationship with Inner Earth ending anytime soon. There's just so much going on. There's too many dangers and risks out there. But I would have to wait to find that out. You know, it's not like I can give them a call and check in or just stop by on a weekend. And, you know, when we got back home, we were all wondering in the back of our minds, you know, just when and how we might hear from them again. I mean, after what happened in Greece, it really could be anytime, anywhere. So anyway, again, we went back to Inner Earth. It wasn't one of our big runaround jobs. But it was still a big job because of what we'd accomplished. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall over at Harrison's when he realized what he had stolen had now been taken from him. And I wondered, you know, if he felt betrayed or angry or, you know, that something was taken from him. And, you know, he probably did, even though it was never his in the first place. Just because that's how people like him are. And that was my job. Going back to Inner Earth for the second time, bringing back something that once seemed insignificant, but then proved to be so much more and could have saved lives and their world as they know it. And what I can tell you is that I have been there since then, just so you know. But those stories are for another time. I hope you enjoyed this vlog. And thank you for listening, and until next time. And I will talk to you all soon.